The following program is sponsored. The opinions and statements made by the hosts and guests do not necessarily reflect the views of WBOB or its parent company, the Chesapeake Portsmouth Broadcasting Corporation.
Speaking of that, let's go to Eddie Iranian. Ed, thanks for your patience that I get on these rants. I appreciate it. Eddie, live in Cairo today in Egypt. Ed, great to have you with us.
My pleasure, John.
Ed, the Iranian situation, the president last week putting economic sanctions on the foreign minister, and I'm thinking to myself, and I want to get your take on this. Okay, so we're going to put economic sanctions on the foreign minister, freeze his assets. We don't know if he has any assets in the U.S., but isn't this the guy you're negotiating with? I mean, I kind of get why the president did it and Treasury Secretary did it. Obviously, they wanted to retaliate. But how does that solve anything?
I don't know that they're going to solve this problem, whether there are sanctions on Dr. Zarif or not. So it's probably just a small provocation. Really, he cannot go to the White House unless his boss says he can, and he knows that Ayatollah Khamenei is not going to let him go. So he's basically playing a game of wasting time because he knows that the Iranian government will not negotiate with President Trump. They're trying to wait him out. He's heard from any number of Democratic Party leaders that they're going to go back to the old agreement after if President Trump loses the election. So he's just buying time. Now, what purpose are these sanctions going to serve? Probably none whatsoever. It may have looked good to a number of people. The people that criticize the Trump administration are saying it's a stupid thing to do. It's all a battle of narratives, really, because it doesn't change anything at this point.
All right, so what's the deal with the British ship that the Iranians seized? And we have a new prime minister in Boris Johnson, which kind of stalled efforts. What is going on with that, and when are the Brits going to get their ship back?
Well, I don't think the Iranians are in too much of a hurry to give it back unless they get their ship back from the Strait of Gibraltar. This morning, the Iranian president, Rouhani, was quoted as saying, among other things, that we will not allow your ships free passage through the Strait of Hormuz unless our ships have free passage in the Strait of Gibraltar. It sounds like a good talking point. I think deep down, the only way they're going to come to an agreement is if they trade these two ships. Now, at this point, both sides are dug in, and I don't think either side is going to trade one of the ships without getting the other ship back, no matter who is right. And we'll put that aside for the moment. And the president's initiative to protect shipping through the Strait of Hormuz has got Britain on board. Also, we're hearing that the French, the Italians and the Danes have said they would participate but have yet to do so. The British have two ships in the area. At this point, the shipping seems to be going through for the most part, other than those British ships. And there was another smaller ship that was stopped by the Iranians, allegedly smuggling fuel. And it's not clear where that's from. We heard various explanations, one that it was from Iraq. I can't imagine why Iran would be stopping a ship coming from Iraq. But anyway, I've heard some very interesting debates about free shipping through these international passages. Of course, the Dardanelles off of Turkey, that is governed by international statutes dating back to 1888. You've got, of course, the others, the Strait of Gibraltar. But, of course, Things like the Suez Canal, these are man-made waterways, so the laws are a little bit different. The Egyptians can stop ships from going through that, and so can the Panamanians through the Panama Canal. But the Strait of Hormuz is an international waterway, as are the Dardanelles and the Bosphorus, and they are really protected by international law, allowing ships to go through. So the Iranians are breaking international law, and I think they're winning a lot of enemies on this. You hear various narratives as to the U.S. Winning or losing friends, but it looks like the Iranians are antagonizing more people than we are.
So we're with Eddie Iranian. Eddie's live in Cairo. Eddie's our man in the Middle East, veteran correspondent, CBS Radio News, Voice of America, and now with the John Fredericks Radio Network. Ed, I want to get your take on if you're the Iranians right now, and if you're Zarif, or you're the ruling class there, and I don't mean the rogues, the extremists that run their military. I mean the governing, actually, central administrative power. Do they have an end game here? I mean, when they sit and meet, like, where are they going with this? And again, separate out the IRA, which has commanders that are very, very hard line, but they're not making governmental decisions. So separate them out. Separate the IRA out of this. And the governing council in Iran, I mean, where do they think this is going to end up?
I think they're hostage to their leader, to Ayatollah Khamenei. And I think ultimately the only real change in Iran is going to come when he dies. And I think that's the bottom line. Of course, he's not in great health. He's supposed to have prostate cancer. He's supposed to be somewhere over 80. We're not quite sure how much over 80. And his dentures rattle. Of course, that doesn't mean he's in bad health. The President Rouhani said today in a speech that was carried on Iranian TV and that's being quoted by all the Arab news outlets, that Iran is willing to negotiate with the U.S., but the U.S. has to drop all sanctions first. Of course, that's a non-starter, and he's got to know that, because there will be no reason to negotiate and no pressure if the sanctions are off. So I think he's just saying that because it sounds good, and that's pretty much what they're doing. They're trying to put on a brave face, Dr. Zarif as well, make it look like the U.S. and the Trump administration are the culpable parties here. Perhaps they are. I don't know. I'm not necessarily sure they are. And Iran is going to wait it out, and hopefully to them, President Trump is going to lose the election, and they're going to be dealing with John Kerry again and people like him that will say, okay, we're just going to go back to the old deal. Now, the old deal, of course, the problem with that is it doesn't deal with ballistic missiles, Iran's ballistic missile program, and I think a lot of people question whether Iran isn't secretly still working on its nuclear program in other locations that have not been declared.
Okay, so now we're getting somewhere. Really, you're saying that the short-term proposition for the Iranian regime is to wait Trump out, see if he loses in 2020 and go from there, much the same policy as the Chinese have right now when the dictator president, call him a president, is really a dictator Z. Why not just, do nothing, lie to them, stall them, do what they did for the last 50 years with 12 presidents, do nothing, stall. And if Trump loses, then they can get back to the negotiating table with a more friendly president to them, like a Biden or a Harris. I mean, Kamala Harris had a press conference after the president ratcheted up more tariffs on the Chinese for not doing anything at the negotiating table and said, elect me president, the tariffs are gone. So if you're the Chinese, you're like, why could I deal with this guy, right? Let's just wait. Same thing with the Iranians. Why do anything? Let's just wait it out. If a guy gets beat by one of the Democrats, maybe we can get the Iranian deal back. We'll go from there. Is that a fair assessment, Ed?
Yes, but of course, a lot of people were telling them, including Mr. Kerry, that President Trump was going to be impeached 4 years ago or 3 years ago, and that they will only have to deal with him for a couple of years. You've got to imagine that there's some power greater than ourselves that's up there that's keeping him, protecting him, the president, that is, with all the people that have been gunning for him and trying to pull him down. So I don't know that that's a good strategy, but that does appear to be their strategy.
Let me ask you something. Did John Kerry break laws by backdoor negotiating with the Iranians when he was not even part of the U.S. government?
I've heard a lot of people say that he has, but of course Henry Kissinger has been jetting around the world since the end of President Ford's term and talking to world leaders, and God only knows what he's telling them. So I'm not sure it's something other people haven't done, but
right.
He's been more aggressive about it than Kissinger. He's certainly been more vocal, and he's been quoted a number of times, both with the Palestinians and the Iranians, as going against our foreign policy. Now, I don't know that Henry Kissinger does that openly. Perhaps he's doing it in private. But, I think personally that he has broken laws. But a lot of other people have broken laws more seriously and haven't been punished. So I'm sure he won't be punished.
Okay, well, reminds me to the original sin of this nature, which was when Richard Nixon was running for president against Hubert Humphrey and back-channeled the North Vietnamese and said, don't make a deal with Johnson until I'm there. I'll give you a better deal, remember? And, of course, he was afraid that if Johnson cut a peace deal that Humphrey would win. And, of course, that broke all kinds of laws, and Nixon never was really held accountable to that. Other things, though, obviously did him in. Eddie Iranian with us here on the John Fredericks Radio Network. Eddie, got 2 minutes. Eddie, let's get to Syria and the Syrian army resuming operations against armed rebels in Idlib. This is the last stronghold that the really anti-Assad forces have. So that ceasefire collapsed. Now the Syrian army moving in, they're bombing them. Eventually they're going to take that back. And then once that is taken back, does Syria become whole again?
Well, certainly with all the people that have left the country or been displaced, it's very difficult to go back to normalcy, go back to the way things were in 2011. Many major cities have been destroyed. Mm-hmm. So rebuilding them is going to be a major operation. A lot of people, a lot of the men are not going to come back because they don't want to face conscription, even if they aren't thrown in jail, as many people worry they will be. Certainly the most important part about this Idlib equation is getting the roads open, the main mm-hmm. highway between Damascus and Aleppo and the road between Aleppo and the coast. Those are major vital thoroughfares, and you really can't run a country if several of your major roads are blocked. So that's part of the equation there. And also having people who are terrorists, whatever you want to call them, on your soil that can mount operations against you in other cities from their stronghold in Idlib, that's obviously not a very good working proposition for the government either. Will we go back to normal? I don't think anywhere in the Middle East is going back to normal after what happened in 2011. Yemen, Egypt, Libya, Syria. I think the whole place is messed up, and perhaps that was part of the game. I think some of the people who were pulling the strings, some of the countries that were pulling the strings, wanted to see the place messed up. And, of course, I've pointed this out before. You've got Brzezinski's book saying, create a mess in the Middle East and you control it.
Well, the neocons always seem to get their way in Washington. They have a powerful lobby and quite the media machine, except for me. I'm their enemy. I'm public neocon public enemy here in D.C., Eddie, number one. That's why I'm in Corey Lewandowski Galactic Milky Way headquarters, and we're barreled in here, Eddie, because I am neocon public enemy number one in Swampland. They really don't like me. Thanks for being with us, Ed. Safe and sound in Cairo. Scott Surville coming up, state senator, Virginia, has something to say about guns, and me and Scott agree on this, that Republicans need to do something lest they face political Armageddon in the suburbs. In your heart, you know I'm right. I'll be right back. Scott Surville. Tim Murtaugh joining us now, one of the spokespersons, senior communications director and spokesperson for Trump Pence 2020. Hey, Tim, thanks for being with us early. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm two little kids. I'm always up at this time. So.
Tim, we've got a lot to do here in 10 minutes, but let me just start with this. You've got parents of elementary school kids buying bulletproof backpacks. All right? Not good, right? I mean, this is reality. There's a firm that sells these, Tim. They're up. Their sales are up 300% in 2 weeks. I mean, you've got two little kids. Do you want to have to go out and buy them bulletproof backpacks in the fourth grade? I don't think so, right? So there's a problem in this country. The president has proposed reasonable restrictions on selling guns to whack jobs. Why doesn't this make sense?
Well, I don't know who could possibly be against that, because it really truly is a common sense approach. We know, and then now that once again news coming out about the shooters in two instances, that they are very, very disturbed individuals. The date shooter, who we know had left his ideology, also told his girlfriend that hallucinations, he heard dark voices telling him all sorts of things. He was obsessed with mass shootings. He was obsessed with violence. One of the proposals, two of them actually, one of them is addressing mental health issues to make sure that people like this are identified and flagged. The red flag laws would help ensure that people like this don't have access to firearms, legally anyway. And additionally, the president wants to work with social media companies because these people do exhibit these kinds of behaviors online. They do give off clues. I heard you before the break talking about the rape list. And because when he was in high school, it was common knowledge. You know, at one point, a third of people didn't come to school one day because they were afraid.
Tim, so you were talking, he had published this rape list, and he had all kinds of other crazy things. And the president says, look, we've got to find a way to work with social media, right?
Yeah, social media, there are going to be many, many occasions where people like this exhibit dangerous behavior, exhibit warning signs on social media. It happened again in this case. And the friends of folks like this, they know that the person is a danger. I don't know if you heard this part, but when he was in high school, you mentioned the rape list that he had, and he wrote on the bathroom wall a hit list as well. At one time, a third of his high school didn't come to school because they were afraid he was going to do something that day. This is a guy who people knew was a potential problem, and it never comes up. These things, the president talks about addressing mental health laws and the gaps that are in there, the red flag laws, which I know you were talking about on the break, which is a common sense approach, and also working with the social media companies to be able to identify and at least have law enforcement go talk to the guy and say, you know, what are these things that you're saying? And it really could help prevent a lot of these things. They're common sense approaches from the president, much needed.
Well, we have to do something because, look, I've got all my friends that are Second Amendment advocates, like I am, like you are. All of us own guns. You own a gun. I own a gun. Many guns. And so it doesn't mean we're watering anything down, but you just have to deal with reality. When you've got mothers in suburbs buying bulletproof backpacks for fifth graders, you got a problem, man. And the president understands this, and we're going to have to do something that makes sense. He has a very common sense approach. Because the alternative is the Democrats keep winning elections, and then you're going to see what's going to happen. So you have to do something, and I think the president is spot on with this. All right, I want to get to Tim Murtaugh, spokesperson, Trump campaign 2020. Tim, I want to get to this tweet that Joaquin Castro, congressman, sent out yesterday, doxing, D-O-X-X-I-N-G, that means making public the names and addresses of donors to Trump in San Antonio. For what purpose, Tim? What purpose did he do?
What other purpose could there be but to encourage, at the very best, harassment of these private citizens, and at worst, to invite violence against them? There can be no other purpose. Here is a sitting member of Congress, who also, of course, is the twin brother of Julian Castro, who's running for president. Joaquin Castro serves as the chairman of his brother's presidential campaign, so there can be no separation between the member of Congress and the presidential campaign. That's what this is. and it was from his political account, listing 44 Trump donors and their places of employment and saying, these are the people who are funding the Trump campaign. It's essentially a target list. There can be no other explanation for why you would publish such a thing. So we publicized it yesterday. It tore around the internet. It went crazy. All the networks are covering it. The Post, the New York Times, everybody is all over it. And incredibly, Castro is defending it, saying, yeah, you're right. I wanted to draw attention to these people. And he hides behind the fact that it's publicly available information. If you go and search through the FEC website, because I know a lot of normal Americans love to just go poke through the FEC reports to see who's donating what. That's ridiculous. But he put them all in one place, names and where they work. Incredibly, these are his constituents. He represents San Antonio in Congress. These are San Antonio private citizens, business owners, many of them, who own businesses, employ people in the San Antonio area, and he's attacking them, all to help his doomed campaign, of the presidential campaign of his brother, who has no chance, and everyone knows that. So it's just amazing. And the Democrats want to talk about how the president uses one word in some online ads, and somehow that links him with these madmen who shoot people, and they say that the president is inciting violence by the use of one particular word. That's ridiculous. But this guy publishes a target list of American citizens, private citizens, and says, you're damn right I did this. And he's proud of it. Unbelievable.
Tim, it is unbelievable. And the way you framed this, Tim Murtaugh, was spot on. Harassment at best. You don't know what's the worst, and you don't even want to say it. But it's harassment at best. Now, let me just ask you something else. The other thing is, part of this is an intimidation campaign, not to donate for Trump, not to wear his hat, not to put a sign out, not to volunteer for the campaign, not to put a sticker on his car. These are pure intimidation tactics that the left is using in order to intimidate Trump supporters. How far do you think that'll go?
Well, it goes pretty far, and it's all about controlling the language, too, and people's behavior. This is why, and we know this was the case in 2016, and we know that it's the case today, is why we know that the president under polls in these public polls, because the Democrats and the media have succeeded so much in intimidating people into being afraid to express their support for President Trump by any means. That they when a pollster calls them and says, who are you supporting for president, they're actually afraid to say Donald Trump. It's incredible. And now they've got people being publicized and targeted by a member of Congress and the chairman of a presidential campaign for having the guts to donate to President Trump. And that is astounding. It goes on to other areas, too. It's not just Joaquin Castro. We're also talking about when the president talks about the squad. You're not allowed to do that because they happen to be women of color. And so if you are criticizing someone, certain people are off limits. You can't criticize someone who might be female or might be non-white. Additionally, you're not allowed to talk about illegal immigration anymore. If you do, you're racist. Democrats know that their position on illegal immigration, which is to throw open the borders and let anyone in who wants to come in, they know that is an untenable position. They hold that position, and they are not electable. So what they have to do is make being opposed to illegal immigration racist. And they have to make it impossible for anyone to even discuss out loud. That's what they do. They're trying to control the language, control right. people's behavior, intimidate them into silence, and intimidate them into not participating in the electoral process. They know their ideas are bad. They know they can't get elected running on their ideas. So they have right. to intimidate their political opponents and Trump supporters into doing nothing.
WJ. Well, they have nothing else. Tim Murtaugh, thanks for being up early and getting with us today. We appreciate it. Spokesperson. Hey, by the way, Tim, I had dinner with your boss in El Paso just a week ago. Your former boss, I'm sorry, in El Paso a week ago. We had dinner together. It was one of my favorite people, former Congressman Lou Barletta. Tim, I got to roll. John Frederick's Radio Network, Truck the Truth Across America. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Time I went. AM 600, 101.1 FM, WBO.
With SRN News, I'm Gordon Griffin. New York City's chief medical examiner says an autopsy has been performed on Jeffrey Epstein, but that more information is needed before a cause of death determination is made. Dr. Barbara Sampson said in a statement that a city medical examiner performed the autopsy Sunday while a private pathologist observed the examination at the request of Epstein's representatives. Authorities say an early morning fire in Pennsylvania killed five children and sent another person to the hospital. Chief Guy Santone of the Erie Fire Department says the victims died in a fire in Erie, reported at about 1:15 a.m. Sunday. Santone says that the victims ranged in age from 8 months to 7 years. The Erie Regional Chamber and Growth Partnership list a daycare at the fire address. More details at srnnews.com.
Maybe you'd like to know what exactly Relief Factor is. It was created by doctors. It's a 100% drug-free supplement with four key ingredients that simply help your own body deal with the natural inflammatory response that it has. It's easy to swallow, four little capsules in each packet, like the packet that I carry with me at all times. Three packets a day for a week, then two packets a day for 2 weeks, and I have just described the three-week quick start. And you will know in 3 weeks, that's the beauty of it, whether it works. They don't drag you on. That costs just $19.95. There's a very good chance that a very serious percentage of my listeners suffer from some sort of muscular or joint pain. You should try this for $19.95. That's all you can lose. If it works, they will send it to you automatically. If it doesn't work, tell them not to send any shipments. And it's as simple as that. It is all at ReliefFactor.com. I've been using it for years now. Relief Factor.
Tired of waiting for your paycheck? Tired of making less than you need? Perkins Express Roofing has immediate openings for salespeople. Great weekly pay, company car, gas allowance, and other benefits. Perkins Express Roofing is the company that's promoting and growing. Call Sean Robinson at Perkins Express Roofing for an interview. 525-2277. 525-2277. Get a good paying career going today at Perkins Express Roofing. 525-2277. Equal opportunity employer. Of course, if you have a leaky or damaged roof, Perkins Express Roofing is the one to trust. Perkins Express Roofing is available 24/7. If you've had damage from a storm or accident, there's a good chance insurance will cover it. Perkins Express Roofing will do all of the paperwork. All you have to do is call 525-2277, 525-2277. Then sit back and let Perkins Express Roofing do it all. 525-2277, 525-2277.
The year was 1957, and two of the top 10 movies that year were The Bridge Over River Kwai and Old Yeller. And two of the top 10 TV shows were Gunsmoke and I've Got a Secret. 1957 was also the year that the Boger's family opened their shoe store on Park Street here in Jacksonville. Since then, Boger Shoes has been providing orthopedic and diabetic shoes for thousands of customers in Northeast Florida. Boger Shoes specializes in extra-wide width shoes, and they offer free evaluations and fittings by four board-certified podiatrists on staff. They can custom-make orthotics in their on-site lab. Boger Shoes also carries many popular brands like Birkenstock that now come in many magnificent colors. New Balance, Dansko, SAS, and Vionic, just to mention a few. Good old-fashioned customer service has been the key to Boger Shoe success since 1957. Stop by 1014 Park Street in Five Points and experience the Boger Shoes difference. Boger Shoes, the answer for hurting feet.
I told you never to interrupt me while I'm working.
Join the live Twitter discussion.
I'm Twittering. Did you get my tweets? I just quoted all over the place.
Follow John Fredericks at JF Radio Show.
Joining us now, State Senator Amanda Chase. She knows a little about guns. She packs. She has a concealed weapon. She has an open carry weapon. You can see her with it whenever she's in the General Assembly. She does it for her own protection. And she has called for more people to carry firearms to protect themselves. And she did a video on that last evening. Amanda, great to have you with us.
Well, good morning, John. Great being on your show on a Monday morning.
Well, tragedy again. The president coming out today, 10 a.m., he's going to say something. Most likely call for more thorough background checks for high potential rifles and things of that nature. What say you?
Well, first of all, let me just begin by saying, just like everyone else, whenever I heard of the shootings in El Paso, Texas, but here in the Richmond area, it just grips your heart whenever you hear about these shootings. And the immediate reaction is, I'm grieving with all these families. I mean, you hear about the carnage that's taking place in Walmart of all places. I mean, I don't know about you all, but I go to Walmart all the time, and so do members of my family, and you know, we practically live there sometimes. And it's personal for a lot of people. And what do we do about this? I mean, it's everybody wants to do something, whether you're Republican, Democrat, Independent. I don't care what you are. We're people first before any type of party. And, you know, I think the big question is, what do you do about it? And breaking down each of these shootings and deciding what are the common denominators with these shootings? How can we identify the symptoms and prevent these happening again? I mean, that's across the board. And I just want to say that from the beginning. And I get tired of when we make this a political issue, but I can tell you, as a politician, I'm a human being first. I want to do something about this, just like anybody else, just like the governor, just like anybody else. There is a cry. You know, we're in a position of leadership, and we want to do something. But what is that something? And we're trying. I know a lot of people get so frustrated with politicians because they say, well, you're in leadership, and you have this power and this platform. Why can't you solve this issue? And I'm right there with you. Why can't we solve this issue? Why can't we come together and take a look, putting politics on the table, putting it behind us. Let's get rid of the politics and let's take a look at the problem and let's dissect it like we would any other problem and figure out what that solution is. And you're right. I mean, a lot of people are surprised to hear this. I don't get one dime from the NRA. And I've asked. I would gladly take money from the NRA, but they don't. And for whatever reason, I have gone through this process personally, just as a human being, you know, who's gone through a period where, you know, before I was in the Senate, I was a, you know, small business owner, not in a high risk position, if you will. You know, once I got in the Senate, I had a number of attacks on my life for different positions that I would, you know, make a stand for, and felt like I had to carry. I mean, when you have people coming after you and you have a heightened sense of wanting to protect myself, you know, thank God for the Second Amendment and that ability that we have to choose whether to carry or not carry. It is a personal and individual decision whether you carry or not, and we should never force individuals, obviously, to carry, but they should always have that ability. They should always have that choice, that if they feel that they are in a position where they are compromised and they don't feel safe, that they should be able to carry. And, you know, unfortunately, John, with all of the, you know, I've been watching the national news all this morning, all yesterday, you know, watching what's going on, hearing all the latest information as it's pouring out in the media and trying to discern fact from fiction, you know, what is really going on here. And, you know, I want to come together as a Virginia General Assembly and do something. You know, we have a difference of opinion on what to do, but the one thing that I would say is the Second Amendment is so important for allowing that choice of an individual citizen, a Virginian, to decide whether they want to carry or not carry. And what I'm saying is that I, as an individual, appreciate that I can actually go out and get a concealed weapon permit, go through the background checks, everything that I need to do to exercise my right as an American, as a Virginian, that if I feel like I have this heightened sense that I need to protect myself. I have the ability to do that. And can I tell you, nobody wants to walk in fear. But that's what I mean, I just have to talk to you from a personal standpoint. Whenever you have people coming after you and saying they're going to run over you with their car and, you know, crazy things that people say when you're in elected office, and I'm just going to put it out there and talk about it. I know a lot of elected officials don't like to talk about it, but I think it's important for me to be transparent.
Mm-hmm.
We do have these threats that are against us and mm-hmm. a heightened sense of we mm-hmm. need to protect ourselves. And so I appreciated that ability to, you know, conceal carry. And I've heard all kinds of crazy things out there. You know, you have to go through proper training. You know, the mm-hmm. laws on the books, if you kill somebody, you can get the, you can, you know, you can die from that. I mean, you can be sent to prison. You can be, get the death penalty for not following the law.
Amanda,
and so me as a law-abiding citizen, I want to do everything I can to know how to shoot my gun, to, you know, make sure that my gun doesn't fall in the right hands. And we need to make sure that when we put forward legislation, that we are allowing our law-abiding citizens
right.
to not be put in a compromised situation.
Right.
And, John, I will tell you, as I have many times before, these gun-free zones actually take someone like myself or any other American who chooses to carry, conceal, to have to figure out, when I go into a gun-free zone, I'm a law-abiding citizen. I have to figure out what to do with my gun.
Mm-hmm.
Am I going to leave it in my car for someone mm-hmm. to steal?
I agree with you on that. I think the gun, look, I don't go into gun-free zones if I don't have to, because you're a sitting duck. I've already said this on the air. I will not go into them. And I give the story. I used to do my show years ago in Richmond in that public building. I guess it was the old City Hall or something. And one of my friends were there. He gave me his office. And I was getting in, I had a key, getting in at 5:15. And there was nobody there, right? And then one day I show up. And there's a Xerox sign on the door that said, by order of Terry McAuliffe, this is a gun-free zone. You can't go in here with a gun. So 5:15 a.m., I had to go run back to the parking lot, put my gun in the glove compartment of the car, and go back. I shut the door, and I said to myself, if somebody is coming in to shoot me because they don't like my radio show, they're not going to say, well, I can't come in and shoot John because it's a gun-free zone. I'm just going to leave. Meantime, I'm unprotected. So I'm with you on that. Look, the last time you were on, my wife Ann went out and got a second gun, right? So we get your argument, right? Our family gets it. Here's the issue, though, when you look at the Walmart, and you were right, it's very close to home. Some guy shooting up people in the aisle, didn't matter who they were, white, black, men, women, children, just shooting people. And one guy's got a gun, he pulls it out, he almost gets gunned down by the cops. So that's an issue. My question to you is, all right, I have a proposal that says raise the age limit for high potential rifles and multi-clip magazines to 25. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, I heard you speaking about that earlier on the show, and here's what I would say to that. You know, I look at the maturity in kids, because I have four of them. Okay, and. Age does not always determine maturity, but I will say that it is a contributing factor. And, you know, we would have to, you know, look and research, you know, that age requirement. I know we just looked at some other changes when it comes to increasing the age that kids can actually smoke and raising that, which actually I didn't support. I'd have to give that some more thought, but I would just say this in general. I have two things that I look at. Does the legislation, first of all, I have to remember this. Number one, criminals will always get the guns. When you're going back to your situation of walking into that state building, you went back to your car and put your gun and locked it up because you're a law-abiding citizen. But criminals aren't going to do that.
Right.
Criminals are going to continue to get these AR-15s, these other high-powered weapons. They will always have them, and that's what was used in the Walmart shooting. And so the question is, do you want to strip or disarm law-abiding citizens and keep them from being able to purchase these high-powered weapons? I've shot an AR-15 before.
Yeah, but you're over 25. I mean,
yes,
I mean, you're over 25, and they can go out and buy a handgun.
What is the age
and look, they were not they were yeah, but they're in the military or they're in law enforcement. That's different. I'll tell you the other thing. If you are, you just said criminals will get the guns. Were these people really criminals? I mean, in when we think of criminals, we think of, you know, robbers and just, you know, people that are holding you up, holding up a 7-Eleven. I mean, you know, guns over drugs. That's what we think about criminals. I mean, was this guy a criminal? He had no record, right? This guy had no record, right? He was just a whack job, drugged out, whatever. Got his hands on an AR-15, a high potential magazine, and he's, you know, going up and down the island shooting people. You know, I don't know.
So
is it video games? Is
it
drug?
I'm just thinking of, you know, if we have, you know, I know back many, many years ago, most people actually did have to protect themselves. They did carry. It was more of a phenomenal. We've come a more suburbial society, and we have more densely populated areas. I think you see less people caring and have that education and comfort level. I think that what we need to do is we need to have more education out there about these.
That's not going to satisfy anybody, Amanda. Here's the problem. You got an election coming up. Okay, I deal in the real world of reality, and everybody knows I'm not an ideologue. That's why half my audience hates me 50% of the time. I deal in cold political reality. I want two things. I want the Republicans to maintain control of one of the houses in Virginia. Otherwise, you're going to be toast for a generation. Number two, I want to get Trump reelected and have him have some chance to win Virginia. And I think he can. If you guys don't do something, you're going to lose suburban women in these suburbs who don't think the way you do. And they're going to say, look, we got to do something. And the Democrats are going to paint you guys as being tools of the NRA. So you have to be able to talk about something.
I am a suburb woman. And Jeff, John, I will tell you that there was a suburban woman, one of my good friends, and I won't mention her name right here on the air, at the Chesterfield Wawa. She pulled in there to get a coffee, and the place was shot up, and she had to go hide in the back. A suburban woman from Chesterfield County had to go hide in the back, and she said, Amanda, all I could do was hunch and pray. You know, I went out publicly on doing a video just real quickly at an event that I was at, and went out there and said this: I am calling on the governor, and I'm calling on members of the General Assembly to put an end to these gun-free zones that disarm law-abiding citizens. And also this, that if a business or private business restricts and says, you know, you can't have your guns and in essence create these gun-free zones, then they need to provide the security, because otherwise these innocent people are like sitting ducks for anyone to come in and wreak havoc. I mean, unfortunately, because of social media and because of the heightened stress people have, I believe, because of the rhetoric, the lack of civility, the lack of respect for human life, that's what we're looking at here. We have a whole generation of people who don't respect human life. And where is that coming from? I was at a church on Sunday that was predominantly Hispanic. It was a very diverse community. And you know, what brings us together is love. You know, we reject hate. And that is one thing the faith community has. They have the hope. They have God, and they are bringing people together of all backgrounds. I don't care whether you're black, you're Hispanic, you're white, whatever you are. The faith community is bringing people together and preaching love, not hate. And that's where I'm coming from. We have individuals in society who, for whatever reason, are mentally deranged. They've been rejected by society. They've had all these issues, and therefore they have, for some reason, something snapped in them, and they no longer have a respect for human life. And that's what we need to reject. That's what we need to look at. Why are these people rejecting that respect, the sanctity, and the value of a human life that they could just walk into any establishment, whether it's a place of business, whether it's a Walmart, and just shoot the place up with no inhibition? That is messed up. That's what we need to be looking at. You know, you can use any weapon. You can use a car. You can use a knife. There are so many things that can be used as weapons. It is a mindset. It is mental illness. It is something that happens that causes people to snap And what is that? You know, I don't have all the answers, John. I don't have all the answers.
Yeah, but a knife was not going to kill 9 people and wound 20 in 60 seconds in Dayton. I mean, this is just a reality, Amanda, right now that we have to deal with. We're on the same page in this. You and I are you and I are joined at the hip in this, okay?
Yes, we
and
are.
And I believe 100% get rid of gun
police to get there.
60 seconds.
It was 6 minutes for the police to arrive on the scene at that Walmart. And I'm just thinking, if you had more law-abiding citizens, would you increase the chances of survival? Because, you know, and it depends on what type of, you know, there's so many different factors that go into place. But I'm just thinking, what if a law-abiding citizen had been there and had a gun in place and could have taken out this murderer?
Yeah. See, we're on the same page on that. I'm for everybody to be armed. I don't want my wife going out when she's not armed. I'm out of town a lot. I want her armed. I want the whole thing, right? That's why after your last interview, she went out and got a second gun. So we're on the same page in that. But what I'm concerned about is when you go to the Walmart, I mean, the person who had a gun pulled it out and almost got gunned down by the cops in the chaos. So, I mean, it's not as easy as this. And I go back to Florida. Well, I'm concerned about the election. And I go back to Florida, and after Parkland, Rick Scott, solid conservative, loved the guy, said, you know what? Here's what I'm going to do. Raise the gun ownership age to 21, put guns in the hands of resource officers, increase the background check. He got it through the state Senate and the House as governor in like 2 weeks, went on, ran for Senate, beat a liberal icon, and was able to hold the House and the Senate for Republicans because he acted. My fear is if we don't act, we're going to lose. Now, here's a question I got on Twitter from Virginia 7th, holding Representative Spanberger accountable. That's her name. She says, asked Senator Chase what she thinks should be done legislation wise. So I think that's where we're getting at today. What would you be in favor of? Increased background checks of maybe if you want to buy a high potential rifle, of scouring social media? What are you in favor of? Is the question.
So as I pushed out, you know, on Saturday, the first step, in my opinion, is that we need to end the gun-free zones, because that's where 85, I mean, we were not going to get held up in the numbers, but 85% is what I'm seeing in the numbers of these incidences, these mass massacres are occurring in gun-free zones. In my mind, in my opinion, the first step is to eliminate the gun-free zones, and then say this with the caveat, if we can't get gun-free zones eliminated, then we need to either hold businesses accountable and say that then you need to, if you're going to make these places, you're going to tell your employees that they can't protect themselves, they can't conceal carry, well, then you're going to have to provide armed security for them because you're forcing them. There was a victim in Virginia Beach that owned a firearm. She was able to use her weapon and left it at home because of a policy by her employer. And she wanted to follow the rules, so she left her gun at home. Well, guess what? She was one of the victims. We have got to stop. Businesses need to stop putting in policies in place that disarm law-abiding citizens from protecting themselves. That's the number one issue in my mind. That's the legislation that needs to go forward now. Anytime we create these gun-free zones, we as law-abiding concealed weapon permit holders are having to figure out where to put our guns, and that is creating opportunities for criminals and others, opportunities that come forward. So we are fully, you know, hopefully anticipating getting some more clarity on all these issues. But I felt like I had to do something too. And, you know, I'm a mom first. I mean, before I am any legislator, and I have teenage boys that drive or independent all the time. And, you know, I'm a person first before I'm a legislator. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to do something. That's why I came out Saturday and I said, you know, enough is enough. We have to do something. We have to put an end to the carnage and these gun-free zones. We have to, if they're going to create a gun-free zone, then people need to, armed security needs to be there protecting innocent civilians. at the very, very least. And that's where I am on that. And you know, as the days move forward and we get more information from these different sessions, you know, I don't want to speak ahead of myself, get ahead of myself. But for me, you know, that's a quick fix right now, if there could be such a thing.
Well, you got to do more than that. That's a start, but you have to do something. Increase the age for these high potential rifles, like I've suggested, I've proposed, or increase the background checks, or make them have it be part of scouring social media. Or maybe there's got to be, in order to pass it, you have to give your medication record. You got to do something, Amanda. You have got to do something, because you're the leader on this. Everybody else will follow it. I got to go. We're out of time. John Fredericks, Radio Network. I want to thank Senator Amanda Chase. She's the leader on this issue. I get a feeling she's going to come out with something, and it's going to be big. John Fredericks, Radio Network.
You're listening to The John Frederick Show. Common sense for the commonwealth. On great radio stations across Virginia and online anytime at thejohnfrederickshow.com.
August 10th, 1977. Accused Son of Sam serial killer David Berkowitz is arrested in Yonkers, New York. The 24-year-old postal worker is wanted for slaying six people and wounding seven others in nearby New York City. John Keenan is chief of detectives for the NYPD.
He was apprehended. He was advised of his rights. He was resigned to what appeared to be his fate. He made a statement, well, you got me.
Berkowitz is sentenced to 365 years in prison after confessing to the killings that panicked the Big Apple. 1969. In Los Angeles, Lino and Rosemary LaBianca are murdered in their home by members of Charles Manson's cult. They are slain a day after the cult kills movie actress Sharon Tate and four others in her home. 1921.
The war was won by Republicans as well as by Democrats.
Franklin D. Roosevelt is stricken with polio at his summer home on the Canadian island of Campobello. The disease paralyzes the future president for the rest of his life. 1988. An apology and compensation for Japanese Americans forced to relocate to internment camps during World War II. President Ronald Reagan signs a measure providing $20,000 payments to surviving detainees of the camps. And 1846. Birth of the Smithsonian Institution, the world's largest museum complex. With a stroke of a pen, President James Polk establishes the educational and research facility based in Washington. Today in history, August 10th, Camille Bohannon, The Associated Press.